official session moderator, again, Jeff Brewer, who's joining us from the Army Corps. Jeff, whenever you're ready to begin, please do.
Oh, perfect. Thanks, Gene. All right, everybody, I'd like to welcome everybody to the 2018 Military Munitions Support Services webinar series. Today's webinar is on QA seating. It's hosted by U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Range Support Center, located in Sacramento, California. On October 12th, we'll be presenting accident reporting, and I'll be hosted by U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Huntsville Center. So mark your calendars. Make sure to register for those upcoming sessions. We'll get that out for registration here in about another week or so. And just keep your eyes out for that. At this particular time, I'd like to thank Nicholas Kent and the Range Support Center for putting together a fantastic selection of topics and speakers for today's sessions. Now, if you look at today, what I've just put up on the screen is today's agenda. It has been modified a little bit from when we first put this out, so if you're looking for a specific time or specific subject, just make sure you take a quick look at it right now. Okay, and then, so let's see here. So our first selection actually will be from Nicholas Kent. Nicholas is a geologist with over 13 years of experience with environmental projects. He has been with the Army Corps of Engineers since 2010 and has worked on formerly utilized defense sites and installation and restoration program sites, as well as civil works, military construction, and environmental projects. Mr. Kent currently serves as the designated integrator for the Range Support Center and as a technical lead on multiple projects. He is a member of the geology section of the Sacramento District. Mr. Kent has a Bachelor of Science degree in geology with an emphasis in geophysics from University of California. He is a registered professional geologist in the state of California. So, Nick, at this time, I'm basically going to turn it over to you to start your Range Support Center introduction.
Thank you, Jeff. Good morning. Hi, my name is Nicholas Kent. I'm a geologist with the Sacramento District, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and the design integrator for the Range Support Center. That's kind of a catch-all title for all tasks and responsibilities not assigned to others. The Range Support Center is happy to be here today to present talks on quality assurance seating, including the introduction of a QA seating template, case studies of several of the projects we assist, input on designing a quality assurance surveillance plan, and post-remedy assessment. First, let me tell you a little about the Range Support Center using the 5 W's, as we all learned on Sesame Street. The where, why, who, what, and when. The Range Support Center is one of the 4 design centers authorized by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the only distributed military munition design center, which means that our members sit in 5 districts across the South Pacific and the Southwest Divisions. Design centers support the design and implementation of military munitions response program projects for their customer districts by supplying technical experts to project delivery teams. And you can see the different districts that support this. From the South Pacific, we have Albuquerque, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. And from Southwest, we have Fort Worth and Tulsa. So it's a pretty wide distribution across the South Pacific and Southwest divisions. Our customer districts are referred to typically as geographic districts or project management districts, as they typically provide the leadership, budgeting, and management for the projects that we support. Again, we provide the technical experts who specifically deal with these types of projects. Some of the specialists we provide include some of the general fields that you'd find on most project delivery teams, but with a slant in experience towards military munitions response program projects, from chemists, different flavors of engineers, civil, environmental, electrical, mechanical, geochemists, geologists, geophysicists, OESSs or ordnance explosive safety specialists, project and program management when needed, assistance with public affairs, real estate for securing like rights of entry, for example, risk assessors, structural engineers, so quite a variety. The capabilities of the Range Support Center include range maintenance, management and execution of all phases of M2S2 projects, anomaly avoidance and safety escort support, probability assessments, underwater or marine investigations, long-term management, safety education and training. And our contracting offices are experienced with MMRP contract awards. Some of the projects we support, here's a short list of some of them spread across this area, as you can see, with projects in Mexico, Texas, California, Nevada, Hawaii. Quite a large variety, different sites that are just FUDs, some that are active installations. And finally, the leadership for the Range Support Center listed here. Our chief, Monique Osterman, is located in Albuquerque. Our geophysicist, risk assessor, and chemist are in Sacramento. Our safety lead, Jim Hugg, is in Los Angeles. So you can see there's quite a distribution across this area. With that done, I would like to move on to the next presentation and take any questions that you might have before then. Since this is the first one to take questions, I leave it up to Jeff to let me know if that's the next thing to do.
Hey, at this time right now, we really don't have any questions come up. You did a great job there, Nick, and looking forward to hearing your later on presentation. Gene, if I could get you real quick to throw my slides back up with the agenda on there. Oh, perfect. There you go. I'm not sure if a lot of you, I know earlier we didn't, I kind of rushed through it a little bit, so let's get started. But I'll run through the agenda real quick. And we had some changes from the original agenda that was sent out. We had to drop one of the sessions in here and kind of consolidate some of them. But the next session that will be coming up will be QA Seeding Template and Seeding MATOC. And then after that, we'll have a couple sessions on QA Seeding Challenges Encountered for the RSC projects, and we'll go on to designing a CLASP to evaluate contractor performance and then post-ready assignments for versus remedial technology. Like I said, we've had to make a few little changes, so hopefully everybody can see the new agenda that's up here and either stay on for all of them or check out, come back when you see the actual performance that you want to see. At this time, do we have any questions, though, for Nick about the Range Support Center? I'm not seeing anything coming in through the line. So I guess what we'll do is we're about a couple minutes early, and what we'll do, let's see here. Yep, actually about 5 minutes early. Well, we're going to go ahead and move on to the next presentation, and our next speaker will be Ms. Cheryl Webster. She is a geologist with over 15 years' experience with environmental projects. She's been with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for 10 years and has worked on many programs, including formerly used defense sites and installation restoration program sites. Ms. Webster currently provides technical support to the Environmental Design Section, Sacramento District, for multiple programs. Ms. Webster has a Bachelor of Science degree in geology from the University of Wisconsin, and a Master of Science degree in Geological Science from Michigan State University. She is a certified professional geologist in the Commonwealth of Virginia. So with that, I will turn it over to Cheryl whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Jeff. Good day, everyone. Today I will be discussing quality assurance seeding and its importance to quality, geophysical quality data and its collection. To get started, this slide presents a brief overview of the topics that I will be talking about. Overall, this is a very basic and simple presentation. First, I will take a step back and present a condensed overview of quality management and its aspects, because I think having an awareness of quality management and where quality assurance fits into that picture will help in understanding the overall goal of obtaining quality data to inform evidence-based decisions at munitions response sites. Following the overview, I will discuss quality assurance seeding, mention the quality assurance seeding template that I prepared for the Range Support Center, and follow that up with a contract vehicle to be used to help with quality assurance seeding or other various tests. All right, moving along. As I mentioned at the beginning, I want to take a step back from my topic and discuss quality management. Specifically, what is quality management and why is it important and where does quality assurance fit in? Quality management ensures that an organization or a product or a service is consistent. Basically, it ensures an excellent quality product that meets the satisfaction of the customer. Quality management can be applied to almost anything, from the manufacture of your car or the brewing of this beer to the collection of geophysical data. A central concept of quality management is the idea of process. Process is defined as simply turning one thing into another, such as turning water and other ingredients into the beer. Quality management is all about analyzing the process and removing any problems or variables that might lead to a bad product outcome or inconsistency. Well, how do we ensure consistency and quality? The answer is through the setup of a quality management system. A quality management system is broken down and has several elements or aspects, some of which I'm sure we've heard many times before. Two key aspects of a quality management system are quality control and quality assurance, or QC and QA. More often than not, you hear these two terms used interchangeably. Granted, these aspects are interlinked, however, they are not interchangeable. Each are distinct terms and have served separate functions. Some other key elements of a quality management system include audits, which you may have been subject to, and process improvements. The goal of quality management is conformance to requirements that obtain customer satisfaction. What is the distinction between quality control and quality assurance? Well, instead of looking at the end of the process and noticing that you have a bad product, quality control are measures that are set up long steps in the process, and these are used as early detection warning signs, which prevent end product problems from reaching the customer. For example, quality control measures for production of this beer may be measuring parameters like the pH, turbidity, color, percent alcohol. These are all measured during the brewing process and making sure that the parameters fall within certain specific requirements. Quality control is used to verify the correctness of the checking of the quality of the product along the process. In other words, it's focused on the product, whereas quality assurance is focused on the process and managing the quality. Take the definition of the term assurance. It means surety or trust. Quality assurance provides confidence that the end product is defect-free and conforms to all stated requirements, and as such, meets the goal of customer satisfaction. So given this overall concept of quality management, how are the aspects of quality control and quality assurance applicable and used for geophysical data and its collection at munitions response sites? Well, that is where seeding comes in. First off, what is seeding? And what does it have to do with geophysics? In conducting any geophysical survey for munitions response, what are we looking for? We are looking for items that could be hazardous, such as unexploded ordnance, or UXO. Obviously, we do not have X-ray vision, and we cannot see what is buried beneath our feet, which is why we deploy the geophysical instruments. Simply put, these instruments are used to detect metal in the ground. Some of these instruments are more sophisticated and can go beyond detection and into the classification of the type of item. To verify that these instruments are working as intended, we use seeds, or also known as blind seeds. These are an essential part of the geophysical system verification program. The assumption is that these seeds will actually accurately mimic actual unexploded ordnance or buried targets of interest. Seeding is the emplacement of metal of a specific size and shape in or on the ground. Each seed should have a unique identification attached to it. What are typically used for munitions response geophysical surveys are seeds called ISOs. This is short for industry standard objects, which are basically hollow steel pipe nipples. On munition response sites, three standard sizes are used. A small ISO, which is depicted here in the photo, has a 1-inch diameter and 4 inches long. Other sizes are medium ISOs that have a 2-inch diameter and are 8 inches long, and a large ISO, which have 4-inch diameter and are 12 inches long. Again, ISOs are steel pipes, which have a specific part number from the McMaster Car Catalog. These items provide a specific, well-studied response in the geophysical instruments. It is strongly discouraged from buying pipe from your local Home Depot and burying it as a seed. In addition to ISOs, you can also seed with inert munitions. However, the problem with inert munitions for seeding is that their availability at your site may be limited, if available at all. So these seeds are placed throughout the survey area and are buried at specific depths. However, not all seeds need to be buried. If you're conducting surface clearance activities on the munitions response site, the quality assurance seeding on the surface is required, again, as shown in the photo. Slide 5. Going back to the concept of quality management, how does seeding for geophysical data surveys relate to aspects of quality control and quality assurance, and how are they distinct and different? Remember, quality control is focused on achieving the requirements where you conduct testing along the process to verify correctness. In other words, it's focused on the product. What is the product in this case? It is the geophysical data itself. Quality data is necessary in order to make evidence-based decisions about your site. Whereas quality assurance seeds are used to assess the process of the quality control and provide confidence in the results. Some distinctions: quality control seeds are placed by the contractor. The seeds are used to test the instrument function. They should test the limits of the thresholds of the instruments, as well as check the coverage of the survey area. While quality assurance seeds are placed by the government or potentially a third-party contractor, and they are used to test the process of the quality system. And once their seeds are in place, their coordinates should be located and recorded with GPS. As you can see, the lower picture is a GPS base station set up in order to measure the locations along with an antenna there to boost signal. The top photo of the slide shows an array of munition types, including rockets and mortars, and this picture is from the Joint Base Cape Cod site. Continuing on, the quality control seeds are part of the contractor's responsibility to test their quality control system. The seed location, the depth, and the type of seeds are blind or unknown to the UXO teams, the data collectors, and the data processors. The seed information is only known by the contractor's QC manager. The seeds should be placed in challenging locations. Challenging locations can include seeding at the maximum threshold depth, which tests the detection capabilities of the instrument that is being used. Quality assurance seed information, location, depth, and type are also blind to UXO teams, data collectors, data processors, and as well as the quality control manager. Seed information is only known by the government or the third-party contractor. A major difference between quality control seeds is that QA seeds are placed so that they are rather easier to detect. Basically, QA seeds serve as a systems check to confirm the process is working. If the process is working, then this enhances the confidence in the quality of the data and the results. Pictured here on this slide are two typical environments of munition response sites. Often on the west coast here, it is desert-like with sparse vegetation. On the east coast, it can be heavily wooded and have extensive vegetation. I need to apply the brakes here and make sure I mention that and emphasize that the point that the quality assurance does not just entail seeding. In fact, quality assurance starts at the very beginning of the project and continues throughout its duration. Quality assurance emphasizes planning, documenting, and recognizing the requirements that will be necessary to assure the quality. And we see this planning, documentation, and all requirements in, you guessed it, the Munitions Response Quality Assurance Project Plan, or more commonly referred to as the QEP. Each QEP is site-specific and is developed with a project delivery team. When addressing the MRS, or Munitions Response Site, a geophysicist should be included in your project delivery team so that they can assist with the QEP. The QEP sets the conformance requirements of the data. These conformance requirements include the data quality objective, and that is in worksheet 11 of the QEP. Also included is measurement quality objectives in worksheet 22, and measurement performance criteria in worksheet 12, or data quality indicators. Elements to be considered for quality assurance seeding are illustrated here on slide 8. The type of seed should be representative of the targets used at the site. If 37 millimeter munitions were fired on the site and you want to look for those items, you would not want to seed with medium or large size ISOs because they, again, are not representative. You also need to consider what type of seeding is required, such as surface, subsurface, or both. In addition, the distribution of seeds. What is the anomaly density? How is it distributed across the site? And importantly, how many seeds are needed? Keep in mind, with new upcoming guidance, if using an analog sensor, the seeding rate will increase to 5 to 6 seeds per day per operator. That is a change and an increase from the 1 to 3 seeds per day per team. And for advanced geophysical classification or digital geophysical mapping sensors, 1 to 3 seeds per day per instrument. So why the significant difference between the two methods? It is because both AGC and DGM sensors have a high probability of detection, or near the range of 100%, while analog sensors have a much lower probability of detection, more in the range of 50 to 80%. Pictured here is a 40 millimeter practice round. So where do you place seeds? Quality control seeding should be challenging. You want to test the limit of, or you want to be testing your teams. These two pictures are from a surface clearance activities on an MRF. Like one of those visually challenging pictures that you see on the internet, where's the seed? It is likely that the vegetation on the site is much younger than the UXO item that could be there. So bushes may obscure any UXO items. Some other challenging locations would include, so it would be in, hiding the seed inside the bush, inside cracks, alongside rocks. And an important place also to emplace seeds is along the edge of grids, ensuring the effective coverage of the team. Moving on towards failure. A quality control seed failure is likely to happen on an MRS project. Why? Because, again, quality control is testing the people, in the case of analog sensors, and or testing the limits of the technology. When you have a QC failure, it is like what happened to this UTV. It is a bad day. However, with a little effort, it can be pushed back on its wheels to continue working. A quality control failure is a way to confirm that the contractor's quality control is actually working. A failure is a non-conformance or meeting conformance requirements outlined and documented in the QEP. A non-conformance will trigger a root cause analysis or taking a thorough look at the problems or where and when the non-conformance occurred and determining corrective measures that can be applied to prevent that non-conformance going forward. With a QC failure, the contractor can continue geophysical work at their own risk until corrective action response has been approved by the government. Unlike a quality control failure, a quality assurance seed failure is much more devastating and serious. Immediately after a QA failure is discovered, any geophysical data collection should stop because this indicates that there is a failure in the process, which in turn reduces the amount of confidence in the data and the results. Rework will be needed, and this has, of course, significant impact to both costs and schedules. In addition, it could have consequences for accreditation. To help the government in developing QA seeding for an MRS response project, the quality assurance seeding plan template was written to be used for any remedial action or remedial investigation. The template is a tool and works in conjunction with the quality assurance surveillance plan. The plan lays out all the pertinent information to quality assurance seeding, specifically the type of seeds to be used, the depth of seed emplacement, the distribution of the seeds, and importantly, the number of seeds. Once all seeds are in place, the final seed location and information can be added to the template in tables and figures. All QA seeds are blind to all except the government or the third-party contractor. It is important that if you have a third-party contractor, a firewall plan also be included. Okay. What if you are a project manager and in planning stages of your munitions response project, and after an initial look, you realize that the considerable amount of time and resources are needed to fulfill the responsibility of quality assurance seeding for your project. And you further realize that both time and resources within your organization are limited. Well, rest assured, the Range Support Center is here to help. We have set up in place a multiple award task order contract, or MATOC, as a vehicle to contract with third-party contractor. This MATOC has 8 qualified contractors who are certified under the Department of Defense Advanced Geophysical Classification Accreditation Program, or DAGCAP. This contract was awarded this past March, and the first task order went to a remedial action project at Camp Fannin. This contract allows for a wide variety of tasks, which are kind of illustrated here, anything from actually conducting the seeding or just processing data or surveying, you name it. And just a side note, contractors attached to this, teamed with, or joint venture with any prime contractor on a site cannot be contracted as third party. So in summary, I have provided you a basic understanding of quality assurance seeding, why it is needed, where it fits in within quality management system, and resources such as seeding template and the seeding MATOC. Hopefully, the next talks will build on top of this one. Is there any questions?
All right. Hey, that was outstanding, their presentation, Cheryl. I appreciate it. Yeah, we got a few questions I'm going to read off to you. And let's just start with one here. Per DAGCAP requirements, isn't a firewall plan required whether or not you have a third-party contractor?
Yes, it is. I'm sorry.
All right. Okay. Next question. Cheryl, you mentioned the QAC template is for RA and RI work. Does the Range Support Center routinely seed on transects in RIs?
We have in the past, yes.
Okay. Next question. For seeding, please define analog sensor. Is analog sensor to only include the use of an EM61 in analog mode, or does analog sensor also include mag flag dig operations using handheld metal detectors?
Yes. I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Sure can. For seeding, please define analog sensor. Is analog sensor to only include the use of an EM61 in analog mode, or does analog sensor also include mag flag dig operations using handheld metal detectors?
Sorry about that. Yes, analog would be anything that you're basically not recording the data. So whether you're using a Schonstedt or whether you're using an EM61 in only analog mode, it's not necessarily recording the information. So I would consider that seeding, analog portion.
Okay. All right. That seems all the questions I have right now for you. Hey, and Nick, you still on the line?
I am, yeah.
Okay, listen, a question popped up for you. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, so I'm going to go ahead and have you answer this question. Question come up, does the Range Support Center support range maintenance nationwide, for example, at East Coast Active Installations?
Yes, it's something we can do. The Range Support Center, our customer districts range from just like the Sacramento District, for example, or Albuquerque, to anyone that comes to us with a project. As I said, there are some active installations like Fort Irwin, for example, that we do support. So, yes, that is the case.
All right, perfect. Hey, right down there, everybody should note that in the lower left-hand corner, I believe it is, we have a poll question. QC versus QA seeds, and hopefully I see very few people have actually answered the question. So if you want to take a second here, you can click on that real quick. There's four answers in there. Answer one could be QC is known to contractor, QC manager, and QA is known only by government third party. Or answer B, which could be QC is contractor quiet control and QA is government quality archery. And C is nothing, and of course the last one is no vote. So if you please take a minute here, kind of go down there and answer that question. You're going to you should be able to see the stats as it comes up. Most people are selecting QC is known to contractor QC manager and QA is known only by the government third party. That seems where everybody's going. Let me see if we got any more questions that popped up here. Let's see. Is QAQC not? Okay, here's one back. I think to Cheryl. Is QAQC used to not do any site cleanup at a particular site? Is QAQC used to not do any site cleanup at a particular site?
Seeding should always be at least part of the quality control, I think. Is that the question?
I think what they're trying to basically say, can you basically go out there and do a QAQC to kind of do a preliminary check to see if we have to even do any cleanup out there?
I think that's what the SI is for, yeah.
Right. Okay, let's see here. What's my other question? Here's another question here, which came up earlier. Do you have studies available demonstrating the detection ranges for analog versus DGM instruments, or are the detection percentages cited estimated? If there are studies, are these available to download?
Yes, I believe there are studies. I don't have them offhand. I can get back to you with that information.
All right, perfect. Well, guys, it looks like we are still about 10 minutes ahead of schedule. And what we'll do, we're going to, go ahead and proceed on with the next one. And that, I believe, would be Dr. Lewis Hunter, QA seeding challenges encountered on Range Support Center projects. Dr. Lewis Hunter is a geologist with over 25 years of experience working on environmental and civil works projects. Dr. Hunter participated in the characterization of the Eagle River Flats as a research physical scientist at CRREL on a side project to the one that developed the composite sampling protocols used for detecting munitions constituents. He has worked on munition characterization projects since 1994, including FUDS, BRAC, and IRP sites. Dr. Hunter serves as the regional technical expert in geology for the Sacramento District as the Range Support Center lead geophysicist. Dr. Hunter has a bachelor's degree in geology from Syracuse University, a master's degree in geology with an emphasis on geomorphology, okay, sounds new for me, from Ohio University, and a doctorate of zoology in geology focused on glacial cimatology from Northern Illinois University. Oh my gosh, too much college there. So with that, I will turn it over to Dr. Hunter.
Well, thank you. Certainly going into geophysics was quite a change from what my academic original path was. What I'm really going to be focusing on today is the QA program that has been going on at Waikoloa for the last couple of years. The Waikoloa Maneuver Area, it's on the island of Hawaii, the big island of Hawaii. After Pearl Harbor, they developed a station near the town of Waimea. And in 1943, they leased 100,000 acres, 100,000 acres from Parker Ranch. And as the 2nd Marine Division was withdrawn from Tarawa, they sent them to Camp Waimea for 4 months of rest, recuperation, and training. And then during that time, Camp Waimea was renamed to Camp Tarawa, and it was enlarged to more than 50,000 soldiers. And these soldiers in 1944 were shipped out to the Battle of Saipan and Tinian. And subsequent to their departure in July to November of 1944, the 5th Marine Division was sent there as they prepared for the invasion of Iwo Jima. And so Camp Terra was used for maneuver training, live fire practice, and artillery impact while it was being occupied. The site was favored because the climate and general geology, so basic site conditions, are similar to the majority of the islands in the Pacific. Particularly, it is well-suited for, it sort of mimics the conditions for Saipan, Okinawa, Iwo Jima, and Tinian. It was a very large area, so they could practice simultaneously maneuvers as well as weapons firing. And because of the geography, they could watch the training practices from the hillside, so they could see what was going on with heavy artillery and the maneuvers. Following World War II, the area was returned to Parker Ranch, all but the Pupa parcel that was continued use for a while afterwards. Based on historic records, there is a wide range of munitions that are potentially located on the site. A whole series of different types of mortar rounds, with high illumination, white phosphorus, high explosives. There are 2.36 inch, 2.75, and other types of rockets that were used. They used a bunch of Japanese munitions. Some projectiles are there, 75 millimeter, 37 millimeter, 105, 155 high explosives, as well as white phosphorus rounds. They used to use rifle and hand grenades. So overall, the Waikoloa Maneuver Area, it's a little over 100,000 acres. It is broken up into a number of sites. And so if you look at the map, you can see all of these different, where's that? There are a bunch of all these features, little block cells that are labeled with, L, E, T, C. Those are all different MRSs in the site. But this talk is going to focus on area of M and N and R. Those were two specific projects that have gone on recently. In 2001, there was a ECA performed on the site, and there were 38 MEC items and over 2,000 pounds of munitions debris, as well as quite a bit of small arms that were found within 13 sectors. Area N is located in sector N, and there was no MEC found, but just outside the site, they found a 105 millimeter, a 105 millimeter round. Area R is located in sector 7, and again, there was no MEC, but MEC was recovered in the time critical move reaction just outside this parcel. So for Area R specific, there were two non-time critical move actions that performed between 2009 and 2012. During this time, they cleared almost 260 acres. 89, almost 90 acres were not investigated, and these are areas around buildings, the airport, fences. Three mech items were recovered during these removal actions, 60-millimeter illumination round, mortar round, 2.36-inch rocket, and a Mark II hand grenade. For Area N, there were three non-time critical removal actions. 1,350 acres were cleared, 235 acres were not investigated, and the ones that were not investigated is largely due to the lack of access to the parcels, the ROEs, or there's existing structures, golf courses, thick vegetation, or proximity to roads that prohibited access. During these three removal actions, there were 71 mech items that were found, and approximately 40,000 pounds of munitions debris were recovered. And again, they range from 60-millimeter high-explosive rounds, illumination rounds, other mortars, projectiles, some Japanese rounds, basically the type of things that were shown in the previous slide. So in 2017, there was a project contracted to do a removal action on areas R and N. Area N is located on the top right, the quick diagram of it. These focused on the exception areas from the nine non-time critical removal actions. So in Area N, approximately 235 acres were not cleared and wanted to be cleaned up. Area R, there were 43 acres. And this cleanup was conducted between July and September of 2017. For the QA seeding program, we initially planted 27 seeds amongst areas R and N. 20 of these were small ISOs. Four were end caps, and these were intended to kind of simulate the fuses. We really weren't tracking these for QA. We just wanted to see whether or not they could find them. The small ISOs were buried anywhere from 4 to 9 inches in depth. And during the initial round of cleanup, nine of these seeds were missed. And so in response, we reseeded these grids with anywhere from 1 to 6 additional seeds. And these seeds were reswept by the contractor until all the seeds were found. For QA seeding, basically, I mean, our philosophy was pretty simple. We looked for areas of thick vegetation, objects that we thought might impact the swing of the sensors. I just note all of these surveys are being done analog, so it's not no digital investigation being done here. We look for topographic lows, site boundaries to make sure they're getting coverage. Sometimes we place seeds near other metallic objects. And so basically the object was to make sure that the contractor was adequately covering the site as they should. Some problems that were encountered. So this slide on the right shows a seed that was placed in riprap on the side of the runway. This was missed and basically the contractor told us it was an unsafe environment, even though you could walk up to it. Yeah, there was a bit of contention on this, and eventually our OESS agreed that it was this seed should be exempted. We had two ISOs that were slightly smaller than the standard small ISO. Basically, when we started this project, we used the seed pool that we had available at Waikoloa, and it just so happened that two of those seeds were a little bit smaller than the normal. Basically, we took the seeds that were from the Poopah project. Basically, when the contractor found these seeds, they tried to tell us that the whole seeding program should be negated. But we pointed out that these two seeds they found, so it was actually good for them, and they were only buried at 4 inches of depth, so we didn't try to really test them that much on the depth of detection. We had another area where we planted a seed, and then afterwards, the contractor defined that as a special case area, and so the seed was missed, and we hadn't been told that it was defined as a special case area, so there was a lack of communication there. And this next bullet down, I think it's the same area. Basically, we planted a seed in the middle of a bunch of debris piles, and so there was about 10-foot clearance on all sides. But the contractor went in there with a bobcat and moved the piles, and they told us there was a good chance that they moved the seed during that, which when we had our conference call, we were a little upset at, but the OESS went out there and found that the QA seed was still there. So it had just been basically missed. We also have one seed that couldn't be relocated basically by QA or QC, and we suspect it might have been pulled, but there's no record of it. So there was a lack of tracking on that seed. So some of the basic issues, and these are the lessons learned from the project. One of the biggest problems we have, and it's come with one of the later bullets, is that just prior to the start of the project, the POH, the Hawaii District's OESS, quit the project. And so we went into the field, we went into the field with OESSs doing rotational shifts of 30 days. And so the first OESS showed up, and there was no QAF set up. And so as part of that, we didn't have a well-defined failure criteria. We had to define it midway through, as the project got initiated. There was no clear definition of what a lot size was going to be. And really what ended up being was a lot that ended up being one grid. Again, we had to come up with what was the penalty for failing of a lot or failing of a grid. So this is the bullet, the fifth bullet down is the miscommunication. There was a miscommunication of grids and or actually grid acceptance. What happened here is when the initial OESS left, there was no overlap between the new OESS that came in, and so they didn't communicate about what the seeding program was like or what the status was. And so the new guy came in, and he was releasing grids before he was checking whether or not there were QA seeds in it. So that created a bit of a tracking problem. And then the original OESS came back 30 days later. He actually went and issued failure after the initial OESS had actually accepted the grid. We observed a lot of obstructions affecting the swing height of the field crews. Some of the guys were a little lackadaisical. Their sensor heads weren't parallel to the ground surface. We also had an issue where towards the middle to end of the project, we asked for a QC tracking log to see how they were tracking the seeds, and it took over 2 weeks to get them to provide us electronic files, and we kind of suspect that the data wasn't being maintained in their GIS as it should have been. So what happened in Area R, we basically accepted those grids based on an increased QA sweep. Our OESS went out there and did more than 20% resweeps of the grids. For Area N, again, there was the same thing. They increased the surface sweeps, but part of the problems with Area N is we still lacked ROEs to get into some of the properties. And also, some of the parcels that are along some major roads that are major roads along the coast of Hawaii, the island of Hawaii, and because the clearance would have to shut down the roads for a while, those have all been pushed off. So they're still sort of in limbo at the moment, trying to figure out what's going to happen with those grids. So now we're going to jump over to Area M. This is the project that's ongoing right now. It's a little over 5,000 acres, 5,740 acres. It was used for artillery training, and there's a parcel just to the outside of it, the Mala Milano firing range, that was used heavily until 1953. Previous cleanups, the ICA, they found five items within what was the Area M parcel, 155s and 105s particularly. These are higher explosive rounds. Removal actions they conducted in 2010 and 2011, and these again are as non-time critical removal actions. They found 105 MEC items and over 58,000 pounds of munitions debris. The munitions recovered were 105 high explosive projectiles, 105 projectiles, and 75 millimeter, and a series of mortars. Of this, 850 acres were deemed to be exempted areas due to rough topography. And on this map of the side, do you know how you get the arrow? Oh, there we go. So this area in here, this is the current project site. There's a geologic map in the background which isn't showing up all that well, but basically the current work in Area M is all in one lava flow. So it's all the site conditions are pretty similar as you go around. And I'll be showing you some field photos from the site coming up. So it's all in one lava flow. It's extremely rough terrain, generally sparse in vegetation with poor soil development. So here is a photograph. Here is one of our OESSs. This guy's about 6'3", and you can see the rough topography all around him. For Area M, we took all the lessons learned from R and N, and we implemented a lot of them for Area M to improve the product. POH hired two full-time OESSs, and when they came on board, they quickly developed a new QAS, and they implemented and communicated with the design center and developed a clear QA and QC roles and responsibilities. They established the quality management plan and QE seeding plan, and we were seeding by lot, and they developed a standard acceptance protocols. And so again, we seeded by lot, not by individual grids, and the seeding requirements followed the guidance given by EM 200-1-15. And all of the seeds that we're planting are between 95 to 100% depth of detection, where we can reach that depth. And so as you see the photo on the side, this OESS is 6'3", and you can see these big rubble piles on the sides. And so, you know, it's kind of a tricky place to try to plant a seed in that and then, you know, detect it. So for the basic seeding frequency, we have a minimum of one QA seed per grid block. We actually get up to three seeds per grid block. They're planted anywhere from 1 to 13 inches. Where we have soil, we bury it in the soil as deep as we can within the depth of detection. Sometimes we have to place them in cracks, or as in the case right here, we pull out a couple of loose stones, put the seed underneath it, and then put the stones back on top of it, so it's not detectable as you walk by. There were some problems encountered early on the program. A couple of QA seeds were missed, and we had them perform root cause analysis. But subsequent to that, one of the OESSs walked around, and they started seeing QC seeds on the surface. After we reported it, and then we had some conference calls, the contractor self-imposed a stand down that lasted nearly 3 weeks. They performed a root cause analysis, and they just claimed there were a lot of misunderstandings of what seed depths were, how to measure them. Part of it was they were saying they were measuring the seed depth from the sweep height of the analog sensor and not from the ground surface. They also blamed human error and a lack of QC oversight and improper training for their main causes. But following this, they started to increase their training. They increased QC oversight. The production rates subsequently decreased, and this was at the cost of the contractor. QC failures, they started finding more of their own errors, and so the QC failures increased, but the overall product given to the government has improved dramatically. And the on-site OESSs were actually quite happy with these changes. And the last slide is not there. It looks like the most current version wasn't loaded. So I'll go to my version in the back. So the basic conclusion is that QA oversight that the WMA evolved rapidly over the last 2 years. The initiation of the QA seeding program in 2017, it had a lot of growing pains, and some of these were self-imposed, and a lot of them related to change of personnel at a critical time of the initiation of the project. In the current phase, there's been a much better standardization of process, and we're much closer to conformance to USACE guidance. And we've implemented the lessons learned from 2017. The use of analog methods is very justified at Area M due to the extremely rough topography. There is a strong push going on to include DGM and AGC in these projects, especially the upcoming projects. Certainly, there's a manpower issue that the OESSs are concerned with from POH, and that is that right now they're pretty much fully taxed on Waikoloa alone, but they also are going to be supporting other projects. So with that, the QA seating contract that Cheryl talked about is being considered for future work. Sort of on the programmatic side, analog methods have been the cleanup method of choice for Waikoloa and much of the Hawaii projects, and this is largely due to a strong advocacy by the state of Hawaii. And sort of some of the problems pointed out that have come up is that some QA sweeps at Area P, these are areas that were cleaned under the non-time to control removal actions in the past using analog methods. They're finding in surface sweeps a lot of material that is exceeds current failure criteria. So, upcoming, there's discussions of post-remedy assessments and development of so they're developing a post-remedy assessment to see if they can evaluate the past performance of the analog surveys on the site. And sort of for the Rain Support Center, along with the CX's help, we are continuing to push to try to include more digital methods in the operations at Waikoloa. And that's it. Thank you.
I appreciate that. That was an outstanding presentation. All right. We got one question for you before we get off the line. Question is, you mentioned that the RNN work was only in areas where ROE was denied the last time USACE did a cleanup. In the 2017 work, you experienced rather high speed failures on the first pass by the contractor, but you didn't say if the same occurred in the initial work. Was the failure rate similar during the initial work?
The initial work being the non-time critical removal actions, that is not something that we were involved in, so we don't have any information on that, so I really can't answer that question.
Okay. For the Hawaii project, what is DevMec items? Oh, hold on, I got to read this here for a second. For the Hawaii project, what is DevMec items would be expected to penetrate and thus discovered based on the topographic and the geologic hardness relative to the firing point?
Well, I guess what I'll try to say for that is most of the munitions that are found there are at or very near the surface. There have been some items that were found at depths exceeding several feet, but these were in areas where construction has occurred, and they are actually probably buried during construction. But most of these areas, especially around Waikoloa, lava rock is very close to the surface, if not at the surface. So penetration is pretty limited. Most of the things that are found are within the upper 3, 4, 5 inches.
All right. Well, that's the last question we got right now, but the poll question we have is QA seating works in every environment except answer A is hills, we have nobody there. Answer B, beaches, we had one. Local shopping malls, which is the majority of everybody, we had 36 answer that. And D, lava, we had 5 answer that, and of course, no votes on there. So that's your poll. So what we're going to do now at this time, we're going to take about a 30-minute break. And we'll see you back here in 30 minutes. Please keep all your computers and phones online. Just push the mute button and go do what you got to do, then come back in 30 minutes, and we'll start up with the next section, which will be pretty much a continuation of QA seating challenges encountered on Rain Support Center projects. Thanks. I'd like to welcome everybody back to QA seating, and we're going to start off with our next presentation. It's a continuation of QA seating challenges encountered on Range Sports Center projects. The next speaker is Mr. Kyle Lindsay, who is a geophysicist with 3 years of experience with environmental projects. He has been with U.S. Army Corps of Engineers since 2016 and has worked on formerly used fence sites and installation restoration programs sites, as well as civil works, military construction, and environmental projects. Mr. Lindsay is a member of the geology section of the Sacramento District. Mr. Lindsay has a master's degree and bachelor's degree in geophysics from Boise State University. At this point in time, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Lindsay. Kyle,
yeah,
you're on.
The slides are a little delayed here, so I'll give it just a second to see if they load. Jeff, can you see the slides?
I can see the slides.
You can work off your PowerPoint, huh?
Okay, I'm going to have to ask you to control the screen for me, and I'm going to have to work off my own PowerPoint here.
I just got word one of our other guys can't see me either. So, Gene, is there lagging and everything, or is it our system?
Well, I can see the slides up here now, so I'll just go ahead and ask if you are participating, if you can see the slides, go ahead and type in a quick message. It looks like a bunch of people are saying that they cannot see them. So I'm going to go ahead and change something a little bit over here on my end. So if everybody could bear with me, I'll go ahead and call up a window here in the background, and I'll go ahead and try to get those slides reloaded in the window. I apologize for that disruption, but if you can or were able to see the slides, go ahead and feel free to send in a quick message into that Q&A window in the lower right corner. Many thanks to those of you who have already chimed in and confirmed that you were not able to see those slides. So I'm going to go ahead and just load them here in a second window right now. It should take just a moment or two while that's queuing up there. I do appreciate everybody's patience. And maybe, Jeff, this will help us get right back on our regular schedule for the agenda here if we just take just a moment or two to load those slides right back on in. Again, I apologize for that brief disruption here. It looks like it's almost there. It looked like a handful of people were able to see the slides. So interestingly enough, it seemed as though there was a lag for a number of people, but then they started appearing on the screen. So I'm going to keep loading this in a little window off in the corner here just as a backup, and then I'll go ahead and ask you, now that I've minimized this separate window where I'm loading things, who can see the case study slides right now? Okay, so I see a bunch of people are indicating that they can see them, and then a handful of people are saying, no, they can't, still can't see them, and that's okay. We're going to go ahead and keep loading. We're almost there with the other ones. This is sort of like a fun game. I should put up a poll here to see a real-time status update, see what's going on. Worst case scenario, if I can't get those things to appear in the correct window, I'll do a real-time screen share right from my desktop here, and we'll call them up. But I will just let the audience know they are almost done loading, and then hopefully we'll have them up here in a separate window, and you guys should be able to see them correctly. Again, once we get this deck up and running, I will ask everybody and see what they're able to see. So it's interesting that people can still see the smaller window where the upload is going, and then a bunch of people are able to see projectiles on pallets, and it seems like a 50-50 split here, Jeff. Half the audience can see them, and the other half of the audience can't, and I have to admit this is a first. It's usually a pretty consistent challenge. It's either a delay for everyone or a delay for just one or two, just not a handful of you. So we literally are within seconds of that smaller window, having the secondary version of the deck up and loaded. And again, I do appreciate everybody's patience while we go ahead and resolve this issue. One of our participants mentioned that something seems to be happening on their computer, so they actually had to exit the webinar, and when they rejoined, they could magically see the slides. So if you feel comfortable with that approach, it certainly isn't a bad idea. Feel free to exit out of the webinar and rejoin. We may just take a moment or two here to allow individuals time to hop off and then get reconnected. Again, you can follow the very same instructions you did at the very beginning of the webinar and just click that link to check in. The system should recognize you as already having checked in, and then it'll let you rejoin the webinar. Again, some people are reporting that when they exited the webinar for another reason and then reconnected, magically the slides appeared on the screen with no disruption on their end. So that certainly could be a strategy that could work for some of you. If that doesn't solve the problem, I do have that secondary window, which is literally spinning and loading, and we'll see if people can see anything in that smaller window here in just a second. So I'm going to go ahead and make the window a tiny bit bigger, and let's see if this helps. And so there was a secondary window that was smaller off to the side. It's kind of hovering over the Q&A window. And I'll ask, are you able to see things in the smaller window off in the corner? And many, many people are reporting that rejoining magically solved that problem for them, so they were able to see the content. So given that, I'm going to go ahead and just double check here and make sure people can now see both, that it seems to be the exit and rejoin strategy is fixing the problem. So, Jeff, what I'm going to go ahead and do is take this new window where I've loaded the content, since it appears to be showing up for everybody now, and I'm going to go ahead and maximize that, and then I'll remind those of you, if you are still not seeing anything on the screen, now would be a really great time to just click the red X in the upper right corner of the Adobe Connect room and exit on out of the webinar, and then follow those instructions that you used earlier to join us for the live broadcast. Kyle, can you see your slides now? Hoping that they're visible for
you. I cannot. I am trying to log out and log back in right now.
Okay. All right, that works for me. I think what I might also double check, it looks like a number of the presenters are also following that technique as well. So I'm going to go ahead here, and if you are a presenter and you need to exit out, go right ahead. Jeff, are you able to see the slides at your location?
I see both of them. I'd have to check with Andy in the other room, but I can see both.
Okay. All right. And so, Kyle, what I think I might do, and I'll just wait just a moment here to have you reconnect. For those of you who are taking that extra step to exit out of the webinar and then rejoin, I will point out that it is possible that you may wind up, due to a computer glitch, be in the webinar multiple times. So a number of you may actually start to hear an echo when you rejoin the webinar. If that does happen, simply look at the top of one of the Adobe Connect screen, and you can click the speaker icon to turn it off, and that will mute one of the duplicate entries and the echo should go away. But if you have problems with an echo, go ahead and use that Q&A window in the lower right corner to let me know. I'll be more than happy to work with you to try to resolve that echo issue for you. Kyle, are you still connecting? Well, it looks like you are just joining us right now, and hopefully once we get you back on in, you will then have resumed your ability to not only see but control. So, Kyle, if you're able to see the presentation content, feel free to let us know.
It is still loading right now, but it looks like I'm in the room and the screen's spinning, so hopefully we're almost there.
Okay. All right. Since we are now slightly beyond the scheduled time, Jeff, do you want to let Kyle get started, and we'll click for him, and then if it resumes, he'll be able to step in and start clicking on his own, or would you like
to wait? I tell you what, Kyle, I'll click for you if you just tell me when to click, and that way Jean can do her own stuff. Can you do that?
All right, yeah, we'll give that a shot. All right, well, thank you for the added suspense for my talk there, Jean. I will be presenting a case study on the Hawthorne Army Ammunition Depot. So, Jeff, if you click the slide 2, should be the presentation agenda.
Up here.
Oh, really? Oh, you know, it's on my screen now, so I can control it. Gene?
Well, it's all yours.
Great. Okay, so presentation agenda. So the agenda for my talk, briefly, first I want to discuss a few of the underlying motivations for this talk, and I'll also provide some of the site background and history. Next, I'm going to jump into sort of the meat of the talk, which I've broken up into two parts, with the first part being focused on surface seeding, and then the second part focused more on the subsurface seeding aspect of things. And then finally, I'll discuss some of the lessons learned for this project, as well as some things for PDTs to consider for future projects, and then I'll consider or conclude by answering any questions. So the motivation. I think most of this audience is familiar enough with the MMRP realm that they know that DGM is preferred over analog methods to achieve cleanup at MMRP sites. And that's for a number of reasons. You know, one of the biggest reasons being that analog does not provide a digital record of the data collected, which makes independent review of the work very difficult, if not impossible. So without a digital record, how do the stakeholders know that all potential hazard items were detected and properly disposed of? So the second reason DGM is preferred is that analog detection results are potentially dependent on the UXO tech performing the survey, and therefore they are not independently reproducible. So for example, maybe a UXO tech has poor hearing and he can't hear his metal detector as well as another UXO tech. Maybe that operator went out and partied that night before and he's a little hungover in the morning and his focus just isn't that sharp. So QC and validation seeds are one of the very important ways we use to overcome these deficiencies and to ensure that the project is getting high quality data that can hopefully help achieve project goals. So now we're never going to get the digital record with analog data or remove the human error factor from analog surveys, which is why I'm saying that seeds are only sort of a way to bring analog quality up to par with DGM. But what the seeds do allow us to do is evaluate the quality of the data and make informed decisions based on this evaluation. So the second motivation for this talk is that the remedial action at Hawthorne is one of the first advanced geophysical classification projects performed on a production scale. So most AGC projects up until this point have been either part of ESTCP demos or on smaller sites. So at Hawthorne, which I'll get into a little bit later, but we're performing AGC on almost 1,000 acres, which has presented the PDT with some unique challenges, which I think will be great opportunity for us to share some of the lessons learned and then discuss a few things that PDT should be considering when designing seeding plans for similar projects. All right, so where is Hawthorne? So Hawthorne Army Ammunition Depot is located in western Nevada, just south of the city of Hawthorne, Nevada, which if you've never heard of Hawthorne, it's approximately about 130 miles south of Reno, Nevada. So there are actually two MRSs that border the active installation there. The first is the Whiskey Flat MRS, and the second is the Old Bomb Rocket Firing Range East MRS. And so for this talk, I'm going to be focusing on the Whiskey Flat MRS, which is shown in the blue outline here, just to the south here. So that's where we're going to be focusing our talk today. The remedial investigation was performed in 2011, and that recommended approximately 4,300 acres in the Whiskey Flat area for surface and subsurface MEC removal. So the Whiskey Flat MRS encompasses approximately 4,300 acres, which is managed by the Department of the Interior as well as the Bureau of Land Management. The MRS is located on undeveloped rangeland and is currently open to the public for recreation and cattle grazing. So most of the recreation that's going on out there is hiking, horseback riding, and off-road vehicle use. But overall, the site is relatively lightly used. So based on the varying potential for the MEC hazard within the Whiskey Flat MRS, the MRS was divided into four sub-areas. So these sub-areas are The flat low density area, which is shown in the green here, you can see some in the south as well. The flat high density area, which is shown in the red right here. The mountainous low density area, which is shown as the blue in the southwest corner as well as the southeast corner. And then the mountainous high density area, which is shown in the yellow up here. And so again, these areas were subdivided, or the MRS was subdivided into sub areas based on basically densities and terrain. So the high density areas here include all areas where concentrations of MD were found or where high subsurface anomaly densities were identified using DGM results. So the high density areas represent portions of the site where MEC hazards are most likely to be present. And the low density areas are areas where we did find MD, but at much lower concentrations. And so the density identifications here are really relative to each other and not tied to any absolute number for density. So what did we find during the RI, and what are the sources of potential MEC contamination? So in total, we found 12 UXO items that were discovered during the RI. And as I previously mentioned, Whiskey Flat was used as a rocket test firing range. So the range used a single firing point, which is known as Rocket Mountain, and it's located just north of the MRS. And historical records show that the test range fired three types of ammunition, which were 2.75-inch rockets, 5-inch rockets, and 40-millimeter projectiles, all of which have been found on-site as UXO. But additionally, another potential source of contamination is the decades of large open detonation operations that were conducted on the current active installation. So the RI also found MD from 155s, 105s, and I believe 81 millimeters that are the result of kickout from the active installation. Based on the recovery of UXO and MD items at the MRS, the RI concluded that MEC may be present on the subsurface, or on the surface and in the subsurface, and the decision document included surface MEC removal throughout the MRS, as well as subsurface removal in the flat high-density area. So jumping into the seeding, the surface seeding for the flat low density, mountainous low density, and mountainous high density areas. So this is the first part of my talk where I'll focus on the surface seeding in these areas, and which is total approximately 3,400 acres. So because the selected remedy did not include subsurface removal following the surface removal, the PDT decided to place both QC and QA surface seeds to ensure that we would actually get the high-quality data we needed to meet project objectives. So the contractor proposed using sweep teams consisting of approximately 15 to 20 operators using Minelab's all-metal detectors. So going into this project, we knew we needed to surface clear approximately 3,400 acres, and we'd be using sweep teams of approximately between 15 and 20 people. So that's great, but what else do we need to consider when developing these surface seeding plans and during the QAP development process? So one of the first considerations we need is how many seeds do we need to plant? So this is going to be based on your production rate as well as either your teams or your operators. So for Whiskey Flats, we estimated a production rate of approximately 10 to 20 acres per day, doing the math there for approximately 3,400 acres, that comes out to a minimum of 337 QC seeds. So the next consideration would be, what do we use for surface seeds? So similar to what we do on the DGM side of things, the PDT decided to use small ISOs to represent the smallest munitions expected at the site, which is a 40-millimeter grenade. Additionally, and you know, this is a little bit, there's a lot of overlap with Cheryl's talk, but also some of the things aside from the technical aspects that you want to consider are, you know, what does a grid failure mean, and how will they be handled? So like Cheryl mentioned earlier in the talk, we're expecting QCC seed failures. You know, we're testing the limits of these instruments and processes, but what we need is a plan in place to effectively deal with these failures and get the work back on track. So again, there's no silver bullet to these questions, but these are things that need to be discussed during the QAP development process. And then another issue that came up is, you know, if there is a grid failure, what needs to be reworked? Is it a grid block? Is it a days area? That needs to be established in the QAP prior to field work starting. And ideally, we would define these data deliverables as something that is conducive to efficient field collection methods or field collection, but also allows for isolation of any systemic errors. That way, we can identify an issue before it starts running out of hand. So for Hawthorne, the PDT decided that the grid block deliverables here would be 1,000-foot by 1,000-foot grids. All right, so seeding results here. So for Hawthorne, the surface sweep areas, USACE placed a total of 318 QA seeds, and the contractor placed a total of 464 QC seeds for a grand total of 782 seeds, which is shown on the figure in the left here. So also note that there are large portions of mountainous areas that are inaccessible to the sweep teams, shown by the green polygons there. So for sweep teams, like I mentioned, the sweep teams consisted of 15 to 20 operators using MineLab all-metal detectors. There were two field team leaders that were responsible for making locations or for taking the locations of any MD or MEC items, and they were also responsible for recording the day's production area. Teams would walk in a line spaced 5 feet apart, and at the end of the line, the sweep team would pivot around the operator at the far end of the line, and the team would then walk in the opposite direction. And then each team member was also tested twice daily at the IVS, once in the morning and once in the afternoon. So the results, for the surface sweep, there were a total of 3 QC failures and 5 QA failures, which resulted in 8 grid blocks being reworked by the sweep teams until all seeds were recovered. So if a seed was missed, it was left in the grid and additional seeds were planted in the grid, and the number of additional seeds planted was based on a day's production rate. So that's where those numbers came from. And most of these failures were related to seeds being missed that were placed either next to vegetation, and there was one failure that was due to improper line spacing after a line pivot. But one important point I want to make is that all of these failures were identified early on in the project, and RCAs were promptly developed, which prevented any further propagation of these errors into future work. So the corrective actions included rework to the failed grids, with additional QC-QA seeds. The teams were required to slow their pace to be able to thoroughly search in and around vegetation. And teams implemented the surveying string to ensure proper line spacing when the operators were pivoting in between sweep lines. So sort of to summarize the results of the surface seeding portion of this talk, the QC and QA seedings resulted in a number of benefits for this project, number one being the early identification of any systemic errors and prevention of future errors. These seed failures identified deficiencies in the process early on, and corrective actions were implemented. Because of these seeds, we now have a way to evaluate the quality of the surface sweep. So we know that teams are finding any potential MEC or MD on our site because we know they're finding our QC and QA seeds. Additionally, we can also say something quantitatively about the results of the surface sweep. And I'll go into this a little bit later in my talk. And then finally, any grids that were failed because of misseeds, these had to be reworked and corrective actions were implemented. So this ensures data quality remains high and can be used to meet project objectives. And then ultimately, the QC-QA seeding process results in confidence in the final product. So now I'm going to switch over to the subsurface portion seeding of this talk. So this is the Whiskey Flat high density area. So this area is approximately 980 acres. And for this portion of the MRS, the decision document identified surface and subsurface removal as the remedy. So 100% surface sweep was conducted here, but we decided not to plant any surface seeds because we're coming back with DGM. So if anything is missed out there, we'll get it with the DGM instruments. For the DGM survey, we're running we're performing dynamic detection with EM61 towed array, and then we're following that up with queued survey with AGC instruments. So based on the RI, we have an anomaly density estimate of about 28,000 targets, and we also know going into this project that the northeastern portion of this site, I know the slide says northwestern, but that's a typo, is severely affected by inaccessible terrain. So we're also anticipating that we're going to need to mag and dig some of this area going into this project. So seeding considerations. So again, we're going off the same idea as the surface seeding. So number one, how many seeds do we need? Well, we need to estimate the production rate. For here, we're using towed array with two instruments, but so we're using towed array that can cover approximately 6 acres per day. Over 980 acres, that means approximately 163 survey days. What else do we need to consider? Well, we also need to consider the number of instruments. So we need to be testing each one of these instruments per day. So for Hawthorne, we were using two towed arrays, additionally three-person portable instruments and two AGC instruments. Anomaly density. So this is one that needs to be considered for advanced classification projects, right? So we're testing both the dynamic and the queued surveys. So if we need to, we need an estimate of the anomalies and the estimate of the AGC production rate. So because it's such a, the targets out there are dispersed they're very far apart. So we estimated on the low end of the production at about 165 targets per day, which means approximately 170 days of queued survey. So so using Whiskey Flat as an example, we need to plant a minimum of 170 QC seeds to be able to test both DGM and AGC instruments at a rate of one seed per instrument per day. What else do we need to consider? Well, the RAO requires removal of mech to a depth of 2 feet below ground surface. So what can we detect 2 feet below ground surface? Well, we need an estimate of the background noise, which is approximately 0.75 millivolts, which is based on the data collected at the RI. And we set our detection threshold to 5 times the background, which is 3.75 millivolts. We also need to develop a conceptual site model by considering what types of mech are on site and how deep we can detect them using our detection threshold. So our conceptual site model for Whiskey Flat is shown on the right here, with the deepest recovery depth shown with the red stars and then the detection depth that we can achieve with the EM61 shown in the blue dash there. So I also want to note that these detection depths are based on a worst case scenario. So this is an item in its least favorable orientation under the edge of the coil. So we can actually do better than that and detect these deeper, but this is a very conservative estimate. So based on this information, we know we can detect the smallest expected munition to 6 inches below ground. We know also that we can detect the 2.75, the 81, and the 5-inch all down to 2 feet as well. And anything else bigger, we should easily get. So no problem. Additionally, seeding types. So, again, we want our seeds to represent the types of munitions we expect at our site. So we use small ISOs to represent the 40 millimeter and medium ISOs to represent the 2.75, 81, and 5-inch. So most of you know that ISOs come in two flavors. There's Schedule 40 and Schedule 80, and the two flavors are the exactly same size with the exception that the 80 has a thicker wall than the 40. So which do we choose and how does this affect our DGM data? So the plot on the right shows the response over the EM61 time measurements windows is almost identical for both Schedule 40 and Schedule 80Cs. So during our dynamic detection phase, we're going to essentially get the exact same response. You can also notice that the small schedule ISO 80 here has a slightly longer decay time. So in the AGC realm, that makes it, I guess, a little bit easier to classify sometimes, especially when you're in cluttered environments. But both are in the AGC library, and both are equally acceptable. So for the project at Whiskey Flat, the contractor actually proposed to use the Schedule 40s. And again, the shorter delay exhibited by the Schedule 40 makes it harder to classify in dense metallic debris. So really, from the Corps' perspective, we like this. This is a more conservative choice. All right, so how does all this information fit into our seeding strategy? So now we know the depths, we can detect specific munitions, and we know the types of seeds we need to use to represent these munitions. And to accurately test if our instruments can in fact achieve the RAO of a removal mech to depth of 2 feet, we need to bury our seeds up to that detection depth. So in the case of Whiskey Flat, that means burying our small ISOs up to 13 centimeters and our medium ISOs up to 57 centimeters. And again, just a reminder that these depths are calculated from the munitions in their least favorable orientation and under the edge of the coil. So we're actually doing better than this most of the time. So at Whiskey Flat, the seed depths were equally distributed between 25, 50, 75, and 100% of their maximum depth of detection, and the QC seed inclination azimuth was distributed in exactly the same way. So that's all great for QC seeds, but what about QA seeds or validation seeds? Well, we're seeding at the exact same rate or seeding based on the exact same considerations as QC, production rate, number of instruments, anomaly density. But the difference between us is, and Cheryl mentioned this earlier in her talk, is that these QA seeds are testing the system. These are considered matrix spikes. So similar to testing accredited laboratories, if you're familiar with that side of the house. So these are easy to detect and easy to classify. And so if a validation seed is not detected or it's incorrectly classified, something is very, very wrong, and we immediately initiate the RCA process. So where does all this information go? I won't touch on this since Cheryl covered it nicely, but the QC validation plan. The only point I want to make here is that we need to make sure that this has to be submitted and approved prior to field work. And that's to avoid any confusion or disputes further in the future. And so this is also usually submitted in conjunction with the QC firewall plan. So I want to discuss just a few of the specific issues that we had at Hawthorne. And so for the Whiskey Flat MRS, we're using the AGC QAP, which is obviously written for AGC instruments. But because we're using a 61 sensor for the dynamic detection survey rather than an AGC sensor, we needed to deviate from the AGC QAP recommended measurement quality objective to make them more appropriate for 61 dynamic detection. So one of the MQOs was the detection survey repeatability MQO. The AGC QAP specifies that 100% of QC seeds must be greater than 75% of the minimum predicted response. So the predicted response for a given target is strongly dependent upon the burial depth of the target, and this MQO requires that the distance between the sensor and the target is known with enough precision to ensure that errors in measurements do not result in MQO failures. So most of the terrain at Whiskey Flat varies by plus or minus 10 centimeters, so the PDT decided that it's not realistic to think that we can know the precision with any greater than 10 centimeters. So the plot on the right shows two worst case scenarios where the seed is 5 centimeters and 10 centimeters farther away from the sensor than the ground truth indicates. And in these instances, the response is considerably less than the guidance MQO for 75% and is caused by minor variations in the terrain. So this is not a system related error. This is something that this is just due to the terrain and is not indicative of a problem. So the PDT decided that the MQO, we would specify 95% of the QC seeds would be needed to be greater than 75% of the minimum predicted response. So this allows us for some expected outliers as a response of a non-systemic error. So some of the results, what does this mean? Well, so far, we have had two QA seeds fall below 75% of the predicted response. So what does that mean for the project? And again, just to clarify, we're using the same MQOs for QA seeds here as we are for QC seeds, so that 95% metric. So first, given the number of QA seeds planted, we're still well within that 95% MQO. Second, we anticipated the potential for this to happen due to the imprecise offset error. But that does not mean that the data automatically gets a pass just because we're within the MQO. This is basically just when the flag goes up, alerting the geophysicist that they need to really look at that day's data and make sure that that error is due to a non-system related measurement error, which if it is, we've made allowance for that in our QAP. Additionally, this is something that will need to be fed into the data usability assessment at the end of the dynamic detection phase. So the other MQO that we needed to deviate from the recommended QAP guidance is the detection survey positioning accuracy MQO, and this specifies 100% of QC seeds must be detected within a 40-centimeter radius of ground truth. So again, the AGC QAP was written for AGC instruments. This is not an achievable offset with an EM61 due to a number of reasons, GPS error, sensor tilt, target orientation. And the team decided that the detection survey positioning accuracy MQO needed to be set to 75 centimeters to account for the EM61 instrument dynamic detection. So what impact does this have on our project? So at Hawthorne, we're primarily targeting larger rockets, 2.75s and 5-inch rockets. And these are really large items relative to the footprint of our AGC sensors, so we don't necessarily require that super tight spacing for that super tight positioning accuracy to correctly classify with the AGC instruments. So because we can still correctly classify these larger items at Whiskey Flat, this larger offset MQO does no impact on our ability to achieve the RAOs. But what about the 40 millimeter? This is a relatively small item, and we do need accurate targeting to get good classification. So what do we do there? Well, that was kind of a tough question, but the team figured that the footprint of the AGC instrument is 80 centimeters. So even at 75 centimeter MQO offset, a 40 millimeter will fall within the footprint of that AGC instrument. So the 40 centimeter MQO in the AGC QAP was set because we know that's where data quality begins to fall off for smaller items like the 40 millimeter. But we also know that we can still correctly classify a greater offset. So it just may take more cued shots to get the data quality we need for classification. And the team decided that the trade-off was acceptable for Whiskey Flat, and the MQO was set for 75 centimeters. So one question I asked is, what would be the result if we had used the 40-centimeter MQO instead of 75 centimeters? Well, we'd have a 47% failure rate. So one thing that this plot really tells me is that we need to be using AGC for both cued but also dynamic detection surveys to take advantage of that higher resolution and higher quality data, but especially at sites where there's potential for smaller items to be present and a lot of metallic debris. So again, at Whiskey Flat, we're looking for pretty large rockets, so the larger offset of 75 is not that big of a deal. But if PDTs on other projects are thinking about doing dynamic detection with a 61 followed by cued surveys, they should be carefully considering what kind of offset their test site will support based on the types of expected munitions. And then briefly, a few other issues that came up. The areas that were inaccessible to DGM because of steep terrain, which came out to be about 93.5 acres. The MRS, it's basically right at the base of this mountain range, so there are a bunch of these really deep cut fluvial washes along the northeastern portion of the site. So these were anticipated, as I mentioned earlier, but not on this scale. And they have they've actually made a bunch of really irregularly shaped gaps of varying sizes that are really small and really awkward for mag and dig polygons. So how do we seed these? So we had to come up with something reasonable. So the PDT decided that any gaps greater than 625 square feet needed to be seeded, and anything less than that will undergo 100% QC and QA inspection. So because these are so awkward, we decided to seed these at one seed per day per team rather than one per operator per day. And then finally, I thought this was a really cool and wanted to end this on as my last example. But so the contractor proposed using a drone to perform an aerial survey over the areas that are inaccessible to both DGM and Mag and Dig. And so the drone took aerial photographs covering 100% of the mountainous areas at a 2-centimeter resolution, and 100% of those areas those photographs were inspected by a UXO Tech 2. So the question is, do we seed this? And the answer is absolutely yes. We're the Corps of Engineers, and if you only get one thing out of this talk, it should be that we really, really love seeds. But we really did want to make sure that this technique was working. So the contractor placed 6 inert seeds, which were 5-inch rockets at approximately, or which comes out to approximately one seed per survey day. All seeds were successfully identified during data review. And then just to give you an idea of what that looks like in the aerial photograph, the 5-inch rocket warhead seed is right there. So I thought this was just a great example of a successful use of an alternative technology that other PDTs may want to consider using for their project as well. I'm going to skip the slide. So to summarize all of this, basically what can we say overall about the analog work now that we have data? So as I discussed earlier, there were a total of 8 QC seed failures during the surface sweep work. So the contractor and USAIS and the PDT looked at some statistics to see what would be the worst case scenario of the missed seeds. So we used binomial confidence interval statistics to look at the probability of missing an item, and that item being MEC. So we know from our seeding that we have a 97% seeding recovery rate. We recovered approximately 1,100 pounds of MD, and we found no MEC items. So if we make a few assumptions, we arrive at a maximum probability of MEC being left on site as 1.55%. So what does that mean? Well, it means that there's a 1.55% chance that an item was missed during the sweep and that item is MEC. We also need to consider the probability that the MEC is encountered and the MEC detonates for it to be a hazard. So these are both small probabilities. So if you multiply a small probability by a small probability, you get a very small probability. And additionally, these statistics don't take into account the grids that were reworked with additional seeds. So we can now say something quantitative about the quality of work that was performed and answer the question, did we achieve the RAO? Yes, I mean, in this case, I think the data provided by the seeding is supporting the conclusions that we're achieving the RAO. What can we say about the digital work? Well, it's still ongoing. The QC/QA seeds have been detected within MQO specifications to date. We know that we needed a larger offset at this munition site due to our dynamic detection. And then our assumptions regarding the classification of smaller munitions will be thoroughly tested by these QA seeds. So we've got 47% of these seeds that are outside of that 40-centimeter suggested MQO. So we'll know if our assumptions are wrong. The seeds will tell us that. And again, this all gets back to, is the data supporting achieving our REOs? You know, this project, there's still a lot more to go on this one. So a few technical considerations, the number, depth, orientation types of seeds. Can the technology meet the MQOs? So if you're doing queued follow or dynamic followed by queues, make sure you can achieve those offsets. What areas will need to be reworked in the case of a grid failure? What is the impact of a seed failure on data usability? Is there a plan in place for areas that are inaccessible to specific technologies? And should the team consider seeding for aerial surveys or other unconventional sort of methods? So the pros of using seeds, projects know more about the quality of analog and DGM data. We get better documentation of the areas covered. There's an improvement in process as work advances, and ultimately we have a confidence in the final product. And the bottom line here is projects need this seeding, period. Yes, it's going to cost money. We purchased over 1,400 small ISOs. These are between $2 and $4 each. Database maintenance costs money. We need somebody full-time doing that. Subsurface seeding costs money in the field. Getting these seeding plans and submittal packages prepared for submittal takes a lot of time and money and effort. But if you don't do this, if you don't do the seeding just to save a few dollars, you won't get the product you need and potentially fail to meet project objectives. So now I need to mention that this is USAFE's view of how projects need to be conducted, and this does not reflect the opinion of the entire Hawthorne PDT. But hopefully this case study showed a few examples of the important role that seeding plays in getting a project to completion. So with that, I'll end it. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Kyle. We are running a little bit more behind. We were ahead of schedule. Now we're behind schedule. Don't forget to hit the poll question in the corner of your screen. I'm going to have one question answered here for you. So here you go, Kyle. For analog surveys per EM200-1-15, shouldn't the number of seeds be based on the number of instrument operators rather than the estimated production rate? That's the first part. This would require the number of seeds significantly greater than 337 for the analog areas if you're using a removal team of 15 to 20 operators.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So that was something where our team considered, and again, it kind of went back to, one, there was a very large area that was inaccessible, and two, this was a logistical challenge from the get-go, and I just don't think we could have pulled it off, but what we did do was the team sizes did vary, so a lot of times, even if there were 15 people on the sweep team, only 10 of them are swinging a Schonstedt. They were also covering a lot more ground than we had anticipated, so we estimated 10 acres per day. They usually covered more ground than that, and again, combined with the less accessible areas, we were probably closer to that per operator per day metric rather than the per team metric, but yeah, we recognize this as a PD team, and it was a difficult thing to overcome.
All right. Well, that takes care of that. We're going to have to go ahead and keep moving on to our next presentation, and that will be designing a quest to evaluate contractor performance, and I'll reintroduce Nicholas Kent for this outstanding presentation. Take it away, Nick.
Thank you, Jeff. Oh, no, it's spinning and loading.
Okay, so we're going to remain calm. Is it back?
It's going. It's doing its thing, I think.
Okay, because we've all been here before, so now we know what to do if we need to, should that happen again. While we give Nicholas just a moment to make sure that his screen is coming up correctly, I will thank the audience again for their patience while we work to resolve that display issue. If you are continuing to have problems with the slides displaying correctly, feel free to exit out of the webinar and then rejoin using the instructions that you followed at the start of the webinar. Many people have reported that quickly resolved their view issues. If you still have continued issues, remember the slides are available to download, so you can simply visit the seminar homepage and click through those links to get to the slides tab and download them locally to just follow along manually. So Nicholas, how are things looking on your end?
It is ready, though oddly enough, it showed up much later for me than it did for Cheryl.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. It's ready. So I'm ready to talk. So hi, this is Nick again. I'm here to talk about designing a CLASP to evaluate contractor performance on MMRP projects. this presentation will discuss quality assurance surveillance plans with a focus on MMRP projects. So just a heads up, the examples you will see relate primarily to that. Some of it can be applied to other CLASPs or other types of work, but some of the examples you'll see will be specific to that, so just a heads up. So a quality assurance surveillance plan, taken directly from the engineering manual 200-1-15, is a document that sets forth the procedures and guidance that the contracting officer's representative, or COR, we love our acronyms, will use to evaluate the technical and quality performance of the contractor in accordance with the terms and conditions of the performance work statement. So that quote was taken straight from the guidance, and some of these ones are too. But basically, what is a CLASP? After the contractor agreed to accomplish the scope of the work that was in the PWS, the CLASP states how the government intends to confirm the completeness and quality of the work using the criteria and steps detailed in the CLASP. Remember, you know, the government prefers to pay for acceptable services rendered, and any portion of a work product determined to be unacceptable in quality will be rejected or reperformed at no expense to the government. So why do we need a CLASP? The CLASP is the plan that clearly communicates how contractor performance will be evaluated. It is created by the government and provided to the contractor for their awareness. Healthy relationships require communication. So in the CLASP, it will help to identify accomplishments and discrepancies in the work product and document them, because those findings will feed directly into performance discussions at the close of the contract. And performance is determined, or as determined by the CLASP, will affect the contractor's ratings following the completion of a project. And those ratings will be entered into the Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System, or CPARS, for consideration on future contracting actions. Next one. And this is a question I saw earlier, a little on the poll. When should the CLASP be written? The CLASP should be developed after the completion of the PWS so that data quality objectives, the DQOs, goals, and project requirements may be taken from that document and incorporated into the CLASP so that it's consistent, so the contractor knows this is what I need to accomplish, and the CLASP says this is how the government's going to make sure that you're going to do that properly. When should the CLASP be submitted? The contractor should receive the final CLASP prior to the start of field work to ensure that they are aware of how the performance will be evaluated by the government. Preparing a CLASP after field work has started is not only unfair to the contractor, but potentially leaves the project vulnerable to poor quality work or errors that won't be caught or addressed. Again, setting up clearly understood standards that need to be understood by the contractor and perform to a level that the government finds acceptable. Who should develop the CLASP? On an MMRP project, again, those are mainly the examples I'll be using, the following PDT or project delivery team members must contribute to the CLASP, because there are worksheets and input that is required from these people to set up specific standards for the contractor. Specifically, the OESS, geophysicist, chemist, risk assessor, COR, the contracting officer's representative, and project manager. And about the input that they will be providing, the OESS and those technical disciplines will provide input to the CLASP, as they will be the ones reviewing contractor submittals, fieldwork operations, and data quality, collection, and processing. The COR and PM, or project manager, should provide input into creating a list of project milestones and deliverables. And the ratings metrics used in the CLASP that will be used to influence the rating in CPARS should be developed by the entire PDT, so that all the different disciplines and people involved with the project who touch any one of those deliverables or are involved in assuring quality make sure that there are metrics in there that relate to the portion of the project that they work on. What is in a CLASP? Specifically, it has definitions of project roles and responsibilities of participating government representatives. For this case, for an MMRP CLASP, OESS, geophysicists, COR, and PM are required. And other fields that might be necessary based on scope of the project or some of the deliverables you might need an archaeologist, biologist, toxicologist, any other ones as necessary, as well as just any PDT members that need to verify the quality of the work product from the contractor. The class will define key milestones, deliverables, and standards that will be addressed, or assessed. Examples of those project deliverables that can be used as milestones, some of the possibilities include final project management plan, or PMP, final QAP, implementation of instrument verification strip, final data submittal, etc. This is just a short list. There are many documents, usually specific to the type of project, analog versus digital, for example. But ideally, these documents should be those that end a phase of work or transition to a new stage on a task order if they're going to serve as milestones. Now, another thing that the QAS will define are due dates for deliverables. So again, some of these could be used as milestones, but not necessarily. But these deliverables will be for documents that need to be reviewed and accepted by the government. So again, PMP, QAP, you also have accident prevention plan, explosive safety submission, a number of other things on here that are all important documents that need to be reviewed and approved by the government. The QAP will also work to define the standards used to evaluate the quality of the work product. Now, the CPARS ratings categories, the titles of them were taken. Excellent. Should be exceptional, very good, satisfactory, marginal, and unsatisfactory. We'll go into detail of what those actually can mean, but they're all tied to contract performance. And ideally, at least when it comes to MMRP work, there are a lot of quantifiable criteria that you can use to help you determine contractor performance under each one of those. And things that are quantifiable could be a number of missed QA seeds, number of corrective actions required, a number of failure criteria fines by the OESS, or maybe a number of days of work that were delayed by something that happened in the field related to a corrective action. The QAS will describe the surveillance methodology that will be employed by the Army in assessing the contractor's performance. And again, milestones and deliverables with 100% inspection by on-site inspection or document review, meaning that 100% of the milestones and deliverables will be inspected, and 100% of any activities out in the field will be checked. And that doesn't necessarily mean that every single moment of every day someone will be out there inspecting, but just that every type of field activity will be inspected at some point. Periodic inspections, such as a QA safety inspection during field work, and then a big one, customer feedback from project stakeholders, and this could be landowners, affected communities, state partners, and other agencies. What you see here, this is an example of Engineering Form 6048, and this one is specific to MMRP work, but there are different flavors could be used for any type of project where quality assurance is needed. And this one here helps to or this is used as documentation for the projects. Whenever there is a member of the PDT that has identified an issue with quality, they can fill out one of these forms, and it begins the corrective action process. Some of the quality assurance procedures employed by the government during performance of the task order to confirm that the work is conducted utilizing proper procedures and in accordance with the approved work and safety plans include the probably what I feel is the biggest subject for today is the QA blind seeding program, as well as observations and spot checks in the field, a review of the QC seed log from the contractor and any QC documentation for review. You could also include meeting minutes from kickoff meetings, technical project planning meetings, public meetings, status reports at different intervals, any of the data deliverables, and any contractor safety records. The QAS will define the criteria to be used in those rating categories, as I said, exceptional, very good, satisfactory, marginal, and unsatisfactory. in regards to performance on those key milestones, deliverables, and standards. The criteria specified under each of these categories should be prescriptive and clearly define discrete levels of performance among a number of categories. So we're not talking about, you know, just QA seeding performance, but as you'll see on a later slide, there are a number of different categories that can be used to determine performance. It's meant to be comprehensive. And these performance levels for each category are the teeth of the CWASP and will be the main tool to ensure a quality work product from the contractor. About the corrective action, it will be outlined in the CWASP so that there is a clear process to follow when a QA failure is encountered. It will define the documentation required, that engineering form 6048, as well as a follow-up corrective action report. The corrective action reports are usually up to the contractor in terms of how they want to format it and present it, but some of the specific requirements of it include a root cause analysis as part of that corrective action report that will identify the nature of the failure and what can be done to avoid it in the future. The CWASP will also specify turnaround times and business days for that corrective action report to be returned to the government, as well as the communication pathway for that so that the necessary people are able to review documents in a timely manner. And those people are called out specifically by their job title, because sometimes personnel change on a project, but it's the job titles and the roles that need to be captured by that document. So here is an example of performance metrics categories. It says CPARs, and that's a little misleading. It should just be the category title taken from CPARs that could be used to inform CPARs ratings in the end, but these are just CWASP performance metrics, so just to be clear about that. This was taken from a real-world CWASP, a well-written one, and we're going to talk about a couple of examples of it, looking at some of the specifics on here. So, again, back to we talked about discrete quantities for each of these categories. Looking at the highs and the lows here, there are it can be a little misleading when you think about what is exceptional or unsatisfactory. Is exceptional absolutely flawless performance? In this case, yes, it probably is. Probably flawless QA and QC. You could define it as that, as, you know, zero corrective actions, that all the QC seeds were found, all the QC processes were followed. And then on the flip side, though, unsatisfactory, does it have to be a complete failure? And no. Say, for example, their QC processes were followed to the letter and they were fine, but maybe there were some QA issues that were encountered, maybe based on a number of corrective actions. But it's a little more nuanced than that. Now let's look at that first category in a little more detail, exceptional. It's the top rating in the metrics. It's not impossible to achieve, but it takes the right contractor with a good company culture and experienced approach. For this rating, yes, it typically is pretty much perfect. Any issues that were encountered were likely QC related and addressed by the contractor before the government was required to do their QA work. So there was no potential issue for a required issue of a CAR, for example, a corrective action report. But the one thing to focus on as we talk about all these different categories is the level of confidence in the work product by the government. In this case, for an exceptional product, the government would have full confidence in the work product and know that what they were paying for was what they got. Now the next one. The middle three, from very good, satisfactory, and marginal, require the most description as they are pretty nuanced, and the majority of projects will fall in this range. So for the very first one, for very good, it's almost perfect, but perhaps there were a few minor issues, but the contractor was able to address them all to the full satisfaction of the government. There are no impacts to the schedule or cost of the project, and therefore the government had full confidence in the work product. Again, some of these specific things about quantities are taken from this class or from this real-world class, but individual projects will come up with their own metrics specific to their needs, based on schedule, field conditions, and so forth. Now, middle one, satisfactory. This will be more QA issues than the last one. Contractor was able to address them, no impacts to the cost or schedule, but again, full confidence in the work product. Now, marginal. There was at least one significant issue that impacted the project's cost or schedule, and this results in a reduced confidence in the work product. And to address a reduced confidence, a data usability assessment could be done to figure out just what the true level of performance or level of quality was. And the last one, unsatisfactory. This is really not where you want to end up at. There's obviously something seriously wrong with the contractor's approach to meet the requirements of the QAP. And before people just assume that it's the contractor's fault, there's part of this process in developing a QAP is making sure that you set realistic and attainable goals. So there's always the chance that back when you design the QAP and take those components from the PWS, that when you start getting into poor performance in this area, it's always useful to look at, are these attainable? Are these reasonable goals? But so an unsatisfactory rating would be repeated noncompliance with QAP that would have impacted the project's cost or schedule. And the result of this is little to no confidence in the work product. And data usability assessment will be difficult. Now let's get down into the weeds here again on looking at that QASP and look at an MMRP example with, let's look at a process compliance with seeding. So for this process compliance on project execution, that's the category there. It is a quality assurance procedure, one that the government does or implements. QA failures, again, are identified on that engineering form 6048 and submitted to the contractor for their review. This is part of the process that Cheryl talked about earlier and Kyle earlier in the day. The contractor will have a set amount of time to prepare a corrective action report to determine the cause of the failure and propose measures to address the deficiency. Using the example of a missed QA seed, the contractor would acknowledge receipt of that 6048, respond with a car. The car would be due to the government within a set amount of time as specified in the QASP, and we talked about what the car would contain, which is a root cause analysis of the failure, figuring out what went wrong, how to fix it, and how to implement it so that the remainder of the work will be up to the quality that's expected. Once reviewed by the government, that car would be, once received by the government, the car would be reviewed by the PDT to ensure that the root cause analysis inside fully captured the PDT's opinion of how the failure occurred and that there were no potential causes that might have been overlooked or missed. And in the example of a missed QA seed for an MMRP project, that corrective action report would need to be reviewed. It could be reviewed by anyone in the PDT, but it has to be approved by the geophysicist, OESS, and COR. So for a different QA issue failure, say it involved work that needed to be reviewed by a biologist, that would be the technical discipline that would potentially replace the geophysicist. You could have multiple technical disciplines in there, but again, the nature of the QA failure needs to be addressed and reviewed and approved by the appropriate people on the PDT. And as was mentioned earlier, should the contractor choose to continue work while the corrective action report is under review by the government, the contractor stands the risk of needing to re-perform any work done since the failure was identified. And as an example, say the contractor's proposed solution required a new piece of equipment. Therefore, any work done since the failure without that new piece of equipment wouldn't meet the proposed solution in the car. It would have to be re-performed. Who is responsible for the CPARS rating, which really should just be who is responsible for determining the ratings from the QASP that could be put into CPARS? That is the job of the contracting officer's representative. They are responsible for putting those ratings into CPARS. And their rating will be an amalgamation of feedback from all the different members of the PDT. For example, the PM and the COR will have copies of all of the 6048 submitted, covering the contractor's performance in the field, as well as any other QA issues identified. And the PDC will also provide feedback regarding any of those quality issues from submittals that were reviewed. And as also specified in the class, schedule, responsiveness, and billing will also be taken into account. So when all of these things are taken together, those inputs will be used by the COR to determine that rating at the conclusion of the work. So let's look at an example. This is a hypothetical one. Let's say on a project, an MMRP project, during review of a submitted lot of work done by the contractor, it was submitted to the government for QA review on an RI project, on a remedial investigation. The geophysicist and OESS determined that a QA blind seed was missed by the contractor's field team. So just as a process to verify that that was the case, the geophysicist verified that there was a missed seed by checking the log of QA seed. The OESS ground truthed the seed and determined that it was not recovered by the contractor. Sometimes it can be and erroneously put in with their seeds, with their QC seeds on accident. So after that's determined that yes, there was a failure, 6048 is sent to the contractor's QC manager telling them that the lot was rejected and to submit a root cause analysis by a due date that's specified on that report. And again, that due date is from the class that says there's a certain number of business days from when the failure is identified that it has to be communicated to the contractor and for them to respond. So all of that is very prescriptive and already in the class, or should be in the class. Let's say the contractor reports back on time with a root cause analysis of the failure. They propose a solution that addresses the shortcoming. The fix was great, improved operations, avoided the problem and all future work. And the fix was at no cost to the government, implemented immediately with no impact or schedule. Ideal. So, assuming that was the only issue on this project, how would you rate the performance? Survey says, very good, because it wasn't flawless. They did have one corrective action issued. And based on that table where exceptional was defined as no corrective actions, very good was, I don't have this up there to look at, but very good was defined as between 1 and 5 corrective actions. So, very good. That's a great rating for a contractor. Let's look at another one. Now for the twist. Example 2. On that same project, that same contractor, let's say they were issued a second car due to equipment malfunctions and went unnoticed by the contractor, but were identified by the OESS from field observations and spot checks. The contractor reported back on time with their RCA and a proposed solution to address the shortcoming. Let's say they wanted to bring out a replacement piece of equipment, but there was a 2-week delay for shipping, testing, reworking, checking on the IVS, the instrument verification strip, they had to rework that incomplete lot. So the proposed fix wasn't at any additional cost to the government. However, there was a 2-week delay caused by that delayed a prearranged evacuation of a nearby community. And sometimes with this work, when you have to do intrusive work in some of these MRSs that are adjacent to a community, you know, based on the evacuation distance, sometimes people are asked to leave their homes and civil defense or local police departments will be involved to help that happen. But it can be very sensitive for people to have to leave their homes for a certain amount of time and then to be told that it's changed can be a big burden. So going back to feedback from stakeholders, that's exactly where that comes from. So, assuming this was an addition to the missed QA seed, how would you rate this contractor's performance? Very good or marginal, maybe? That's a pretty big difference there between very good, which was the second best, versus marginal, which was the second worst. And this is where clear definitions are important. Oh, hang on, where'd that go? The difference between very good and marginal is immense for a contractor and relies on your interpretation of a scheduled delay in this case based on what was in that table. An impact to the schedule may only be a delay in the final report on some projects. You know, a little bit late on that might not be such a big deal, but some delays may require a major effort to reschedule stakeholders or other tasks that were dependent upon a agreed-upon schedule. So making sure that the government's expectations of the contractor's performance, they need to make sure that they're not only attainable, as I mentioned earlier, but worded so that there's no chance for confusion. So for this hypothetical project, if the impact of the schedule could be reworded maybe to an impact to the completion date of more than 2 weeks, that would be a useful metric there that's quantifiable. But, you know, for most projects with enough of the scheduling and wiggle room that's allowed based on production in the field, it's not usually an issue, but it can be. But that's just an example there about quantifiable metrics. So design in these category metrics. You need to remember to scale those metrics to fit with your project. While some of the examples on that table that I showed have discrete numbers, they're also based on a percentage of total QA seeds on a project, you know, how many could be missed, how many potential cars you might generate. But those metrics should be specific to your project because there are challenging circumstances unique to every project that should be taken into consideration. For example, difficult terrain, sensor performance, the remoteness of the site. The contractor's selected sensor technology may also need to be taken into account. As we've mentioned, analog has a lower probability of detection than DGM or AGC. So, in closing, a well-written QASP will be your best tool if you encounter quality issues on a project, allowing you to point to stated processes to ensure that standards are met. Therefore, you really should invest a decent amount of time developing the metrics that capture the goals of the project in measurable increments for each one of those five categories, from exceptional to unsatisfactory. Remember, a poorly written QASP could be filled with loopholes and or hard-to-parse language that will lead to confusion for both the government and contractors. Because remember, what the government wants is successful performance on a project, and that can only happen when both the government and the contractor work together with known and clear standards for performance. So thank you very much for your time and participation on this presentation. I'll now refer all questions to the CX. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Nick. Hey, we are running really short on time, so we don't have any time for questions. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to have Gene give me a copy of all the questions at the end of the presentations, and then we can get those emailed out to our presenters, and then they can email the people asking the questions, try to get them an answer. We're going to have to move on to our next presentation. It'll be Post-Remedy Assessment versus Remedial Technology by Dr. Corey Koger. Dr. Koger is a senior chemist and toxicologist with over 19 years of experience with environmental projects. He's been with the Army Corps of Engineers since 2001 and has worked on support for other programs such as flood sites, insulation restoration program sites, as well as civil works, military construction, and environmental projects. Dr. Koger currently serves as the lead risk assessor for the Rain Support Center and as the water quality program manager for the South Pacific Division. He's a member of the chemistry section in the Sacramento District. Dr. Koger has a PhD in pharmacology and toxicology from the University of California. He also has a master's degree in chemistry and bachelor's degree in chemistry and biology from the University of California. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Corey.
All right. Thank you, Jeff. I'm currently looking at the blue dial of Wait For It. So can anyone else see the slides? There they are. Okay, great. Thank you. How this applies to the QA/QC process for seeding will become apparent as we go through the talk, but I would like to discuss the post-remedy assessment versus the remedial technology that's chosen. And in that vein, I believe in beginning with the end in mind, and the decisions that go into the remedial technology and or investigative technology start in the RI for the most part. So we're probably going to start there and discuss that in more detail. The remedial investigation or investigative technology overview, there are basically three technologies. There's the analog technology, digital geophysical magnetometers, or DGM, and advanced geophysical classification, or AGC. These have all been discussed in some detail, and I'll go into a little bit more detail in the next slides. Coupled with that are statistical programs, and the most used is the visual sample plan, or VSP. That can start with the remedial investigation and transect design. The goal of ESP and transect design is to get a density estimate to evaluate remedial alternatives and to identify potential high density and low density areas. You can use VSP in the remedial design, and coupled with that are the remedial action objectives. What's the end goal? And that is where we use the remedial action objectives speedwagon, or the new risk evaluation process that's being proposed by the Corps. For post-remedial evaluation or the verification step, you can use VSP to verify your data collection, as well as RAO Speedwagon to look at post-remedy assessments. And that's the FUDS training course 428. So I'm not going to discuss it too much further, but that is available. So here's a closer look at the remedial technologies that we've been discussing. Analog technologies have some positives. Real-time observations. The anomalies can be flagged and excavated immediately, and there are few field restraints such as vegetation or topography. However, and as has discussed, the data quality depends on human factors, including attentiveness, distraction, and hearing ability, and as Kyle alluded to, the amount of drinking the night before. The probability of detection based on ITRC research ranges from about 50 to 72%. You do not get a permanent record of after the fact. Data analysis is not possible. And I think the critical take-home message here is that analog does not meet the DoD policy requirements for reproducible results or the policy requirements under the UXO management principles. That being said, there may not be any other option based on the topography or terrain or vegetation. For DGM, positives include the digital record and georeferencing the data to anomaly locations. You have a permanent electronic record after data collection. The probability of detection approaches 100%, and the results are reproducible. However, you may have some vegetation or topography constraints that may impede function and usability. Finally, you have advanced geophysical classification. The same positives, digital record, a permanent electronic copy. Probability again approaches 100%. The results are reproducible. You also get a higher quality data and greater confidence in that data. And typically, if this is used in its best sense, is less intrusive field work. You're going to have fewer digs, which has implications for areas where you may have to have evacuations based upon a minimum frag distance. Finally, you have a positive in that there's accreditation of the performing organizations, which is not typical for DGM or analog technologies. Again, vegetation and topography may limit access or impede function. Another tool, and again, this is specific to the RIFS, there's a draft munitions response quality project plan, or the MRQAP, that is being produced by the Intergovernmental Data Quality Task Force for Munitions Response, and the subgroup that is comparing that is the MRQAP guidance. The current requirements for QAP under the United Uniform Federal Policy for Quality Assurance Project Plans is the link there. I recommend going to the optimized UFP QAP worksheets because they streamline the process. And the MRQAP that's being produced, that's in its draft form and is under review right now, it came out in February 2018, follows the optimized UFP QAP worksheets. As Kyle alluded to, there's also an AGC QAP that's available for remedial response. So under the draft QAP that's being produced, there are a number of the worksheet templates, not all of them currently, but the ones that are available are the draft worksheet number 9, number 10, number 11, number 12, number 17, and number 22, and I'll go into these in a little bit more detail. We're going to spend, bear with me, we're going to spend quite a few minutes on this slide. And finally, the uses and limitations of analog geophysical technology. So for the draft worksheet number 9, which is the project planning worksheet, there's nothing new in any of these worksheets. It's just to kind of normalize the munitions response process and program. Under project planning, the things to note is that it's a dynamic planning process. The recommendation is for 6 planning sessions, 4 prior to any site characterization, and then 2 after some preliminary surveys, so actually after some field work has occurred. So you're going to update your conceptual site model as well as worksheet number 17, which is the sample design based upon the initial surveys. For draft worksheet number 10, which is the conceptual site model, this is where the decision for your remedial sensor or your investigative sensor comes into play. And the critical components of that are the munitions that are known or suspected on the site, whether or not you have a range, a classic range, where you have a firing point and a target, or whether you have a maneuver area and how that feeds into your conceptual site model, whether you have existing data, perhaps from a TICRA, as Lou Hunter alluded to, or previous investigations, where you know you have high density versus low density areas. And finally, the terrain for your site, which may be the deciding factor for which technology you might use to detect anomalies. So at this point, it may be critical to get regulator buy-in or stakeholder buy-in about the choice of technology that might be used or sensor technology that might be used. And it may be time to start seeing whether or not you're going to digitally map the site using LIDAR or some other innovative technology so that you can actually break out the areas that are going to be investigated with AGC, DGM, or analog technology. For worksheet 11, the data quality objectives, basically the goal is to get to a baseline risk assessment and to feed the feasibility study to look at alternatives. So will you have enough data to evaluate whether those alternatives achieve an acceptable end state? For worksheet number 12, the measurement performance criteria, this is where the discussion about QA/QC seeding comes into play, whether we have adequate data validation and data verification, and we're looking at the accuracy, completeness, and representativeness of that data. In other words, do we have confidence in the data, and can we use that data, the data usability analysis, to make decisions based upon the remedial alternatives? For worksheet number 17, the sample design, again, that keys into the type of sensor technology that's going to be used on the site, whether or not you've met the MQOs, and whether or not the minimum required work products have been performed. And finally, and specifically, this document discusses the limitations of analog geophysical technology, and there's a fact sheet associated with that. And so the key takeaway from this particular document, again, the QAP worksheets are nothing new. They've been around for a long time. I think there's a rigorous amount of work that went into it, and there's a lot of good information that can be used by the project team. However, analog tools do not represent the best available detection science, and project teams should disclose the uses and limitations of the data as qualitative and subjective. That being said, the QAQ process and the seeding program then needs to be that much more rigorous, and you have to involve your regulatory agencies that much further in your project. Also, the Department of Army 2017 guidance recommends AGC recommendation for all FUDS projects rather than analog or DGM detection systems where applicable. So again, we're going to discuss the RAO Speedwagon briefly. This is selecting and evaluating remedial alternatives. The long story short, and I recommend taking the FUDS class, is does the remedial action performed meet the remedial action objectives and reduce risk to an acceptable level? The definition of acceptable level, again, will be between the project team, the performing organization, and the regulatory agencies. So some key factors of many used to answer that above question are, were data quality objectives met? And how do we do that? It's the competence in the process and the data requirements, which goes back to the QA-QC seeding process. And finally, and I know we're running short of time, so I'm cutting kind of short. If analog technology is or was used, are there areas within the MRS where DGM or AGC could provide quantitative statistical confidence to support the post-remedy assessment? In other words, are there areas on the project that could be used to vet the analog data and provide a higher level of confidence and therefore a higher level of decision making? And that is my brief presentation to get us back on time. Do we have any questions?
All right, Corey, appreciate that. Let's see what we have here. We don't have any questions in the queue right now for you, but if we can get Nick back on the phone here. I think we got a few for you. Let's see. Let me do work. There we go, that one. All right, let's see. You're on there, Nick?
I am.
All right, here, this goes. Since we've got a little bit of time right now, we're going to ask a couple of questions up from your presentation. For the drone survey, were any seeds placed beneath the cover of the surface vegetation?
I think that was a question for Kyle.
All right, maybe Kyle, get Kyle back on.
No, I don't believe any were placed beneath the vegetation. These were just aerial photographs, so we're not getting any kind of penetration through the vegetation.
All right. Let's see here. I guess this in regards to... All right, this is probably another one for you, Kyle. In regards to QA and QC seeding densities, it was briefly mentioned earlier that the new standard will be 5 to 6 seeds per day per operator during analog operations. If I understand correctly, QA and QC are seedings at this density, and it is not a combined seeding density.
Yes, correct. For the future increase in the QA-QC seeding, you're right. It is not a combined density. Right now, QA is the QA seeding density is basically mirroring the QC seeding density. So the 201.15 is written as for guidance for QC seeding, and QA is mirroring those numbers.
Perfect. All right. One last question. Were any MPPEH identified during the drone flyover survey?
I don't recall. I know, so for at least within the MRS, there were no MPPEH identified. Most of it was old gold mine claims or rocks that had that cylindrical UXO type of shape. But I do not remember if we found one just outside of the MRS. And so in that case, what we do is those coordinates are provided to the active installation, and they send out a UXO team to dispose of the – well, first to investigate it, and then if it is MPPH, to dispose of it.
Perfect. All right. One last question, and this will definitely be it. Is cost a factor when choosing between analog and DGM or AGC?
Absolutely. I mean, everything is a factor. Really, I mean, where you're going is your remedial action objective. So if you can achieve what you need to achieve at a site with a cheaper remedy, then absolutely. But, if you need those AGC or DGM, then you absolutely, cannot substitute analog for those to try and achieve your RAO.
Perfect. All right, folks, that concludes our question and answer session. I appreciate everybody attending our webinar series today. Gene, can you pop up my last slide there?
Oh, sorry, let me go ahead and call your last slide up there, not my last slide. We'll go ahead and close things out today.
Real quick. Hey, just remember, everybody, that the We got on October 12th, we'll have a webinar on accident reporting. I'll have that out hopefully in the next week for registration, so everybody can get up there and sign up for that one. And it's been a pleasure. If you have any questions about the webinar or what we're doing, just kind of go ahead and contact me at my office or send an email. And other than that, have a good day, folks. Gene, it's up to you now.
All right. Thank you so very much, Jeff. So let me just walk the audience through a few final reminders before we go ahead and close things out today. Presentation content is currently available to download from the seminar links or resources page. I want to remind everyone that contact information for our presenters and organizers is also available on that very same seminar homepage. You'll find those links on the middle right of your screen. Simply scroll through the related URLs window, click on the link of interest, and press the Browse To button to open it up on your end. I will ask each of you to take a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's delivery, both in the method that we used to deliver it, as well as the content that was covered. While we do not offer CEUs or PDHs for these seminars, you can download a participation certificate immediately after submitting feedback for the event. Just make sure you check the box at the bottom of that feedback form, ensuring you are here for the entire session. And once you send in your feedback form, you'll immediately have access to either download or print out your certificate. If you happen to participate in a group, each one of you can actually follow the link to that feedback form and fill out your own form to get your own certificate, regardless whether or not you registered individually. I do want to echo thanks to all of you who were patient with us and very flexible as we ran into a few display issues, and thanks to those of you who were able to chime in with ways to resolve it, and then again, just confirming that things were or were not working really does help us respond to those issues in real time. Today's session was recorded as the others in the M2S2 series here on Kluin, and you'll automatically receive an email once that recording is available for on-demand playback. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that we will hear from you on a future seminar. Thank you so very much for joining us. This will be